Good evening. You're very welcome to the Arts Programme here at Near FM. I'm John Connell, and this evening I talk to Nessa Power, daughter of Patrick J. Power, whose recent book, Light Reading for Short Journeys, has been published. And I asked Nessa Power to describe the book.
Yes, so Light Reading for Short Journeys is my dad's book of short memoirs, and all the pieces in this collection have been previously published in magazines and newspapers from about the 1970s up to 2000 in magazines such as Cara, Ireland's Own, Sacred Heart Messenger, The Evening Press, lots of different publications. So they're all together in one book for the first time, and they range from short memoirs about my dad's past and his growing up in Ireland, and then the middle section is some writing advice about how to write a play, short story, and then the last section is more about current events that were going on at the time and my dad's take on them, and you know, they're interesting.
So Nessa, would you like to read a story from the book?
I would. I'd read. So the beauty of this book is that you can dip in and out. It's we thought that during the pandemic, people would like something not too heavy. And I know a lot of people are finding it hard to concentrate on reading. So, you know, light reading is an appealing kind of idea, I think. So the beauty of it is you can dip in and out. You don't need to read these in chronological order. You might be in the mood for a certain thing in one day, and hopefully this will give you a bit of a flavour of what's on offer. My Digs Odyssey by Patrick J. Power. A few years after the end of World War II, aged 18, I arrived in Dublin to start my first job. I was part of an inflow of young people from rural Ireland into the capital to meet an expanding demand for staff in the public sector. Speaking with country accents and unaccustomed to city ways, we were seen as intruders by many native Dubliners. We took on a separate identity and for many years remained a distinct group in an unfamiliar environment. For a start, we had to find somewhere to stay in a large city in which few of us had set foot before. Hours were spent scanning the accommodation columns in the evening paper, then calling from address to address. Finding a suitable place was often hit and miss, and the only sure way was to get a recommendation from a friend or relative. The result was that people from a particular town or village often congregated in the same district, with clusters in Rathmines and Ranelagh on the south side, and north of the river in Fairview, Phibsborough and Glasnevin. Another peculiarity was that very few girls stayed in digs, preferring to rent bedsits and cater for themselves, so that digs were almost exclusively a male domain. In those less permissive times, landladies were averse to mixing the genders. In my years in digs, I came across only one female, the middle-aged man, wife of a man who worked in Cleary's department store. In my own case, having endured a harsh boarding school regime for the previous 5 years, my new freedom was a tremendous relief. But for many, the city was a lonely place. Visits home were restricted by a lack of money and were largely confined to Christmas, Easter, and summer holidays. There were no long-distance buses then operating on cheap fares to rural areas, so the travel was a major expense. Telephone calls were not an option either, because few family homes had phones, so letters were the main means of keeping in touch. In today's global environment, there are Irish people in Asia, Australia, and America who have more contact with their loved ones than digs dwellers had in Dublin little more than half a century ago. Our social life followed a fairly routine pattern. On weekdays, we went to the cinema or visited the local pub for a pint. On other evenings, if the digs were congenial, we stayed in chatting, reading, playing cards, or listening to the radio. National television was still more than a decade off. The weekends were busier. Many of us played football or hurling on Saturday afternoons, and Sunday mornings, cycling to matches in the 15 acres in the Phoenix Park, or to the various club grounds in the city suburbs. On Sunday afternoons, we attended Croke Park en masse, particularly during the championship season, to cheer our own county or provincial representatives. Hill 16 was the usual vantage point, but if the weather was bad, we moved across to the shelter of the Cusack stand. The highlight of the weekend was to go dancing in one of the many ballrooms in Parnell Square. The National, the Teachers, the Foresters, or the Iron. Most of us had two left feet and couldn't dance very well, so we made up our own steps. In the melee of a Paul Jones, the Walls of Limerick, or a mixed excuse me, many a pair of patent high heels or court shoes suffered serious damage. Those of us fed up making a show of ourselves took lessons in a dancing school to learn the foxtrot, the quickstep, the tango, and the old time waltz. Personally, I wasn't a success. I went in with two left feet and came out with them. After the dance ended at midnight, another time-honoured custom was to have a snack in one of the milk bars around the city centre and inner suburbs. This consisted usually of a pint of milk and a cake to replace lost energy. The cakes most in demand were a coconut slice, a gurra cake, or a nosebleed, so called because the main ingredient was raspberry jam. Life was not all enjoyment. Evening classes in Trinity and UCD were popular then, and quite a few of us went on to study for degrees in arts, commerce, and economics. Working normal hours in your job and then going directly to lectures was a hard grind. By the time you had a supper of some kind and had written up your notes, it was often past midnight. Among those evening class graduates were people who later became top civil servants. Others achieved prominence in public life, and a few went on to amass fortunes in industry. Changing digs was a regular occurrence and took place for a variety of reasons. A row with a landlady or a fellow boarder, dissatisfaction with the food or accommodation, an increase in charges, or, in my own case, plain wanderlust. Few stayed in the same digs for longer than a year. My own odyssey followed that pattern. In 9 years in digs, I lived at 8 addresses. Moving to a new digs was a simple enough operation. Everything you owned was crammed into a bulging suitcase, tied with twine if the contents exceeded the capacity, balanced precariously on the handlebars of a bicycle, and transported to the new destination. You cycled if you could avoid the suitcase with your knees, but otherwise you walked. If you didn't have a bicycle, you made the move by bus, leaving your case on the platform and sitting downstairs on the bench seat at the back to keep an eye on it. Sometimes one or two friends from the old digs accompanied you, and the evening ended with solemn promises to keep in touch. Such was the transient nature of our lifestyles that few of us kept those promises. In my own case, after nearly a decade of shifting around various houses in Glasnevin and Phibsborough on the north side, I moved across the Liffey to a bedsit on the South Circular Road. There, one day, as I sat watching passing traffic, a tall, striking girl walked down the footpath on the far side of the road and entered the house directly opposite. As the weeks passed, I watched out for her, becoming more and more entranced. I racked my brain for some way to meet her, but could think of nothing sensible. Normally shy, after 6 months, I ended the torture of indecision and summoned up the will and courage to cross the road. Heart pounding, I rang the doorbell and introduced myself. 4 years later, we were married and bought a house in the developing suburban village of Rohini. I was back on the north side again, and my digs odyssey was over.
Lovely stuff. Would you like to talk about your father's life?
Yeah. So my dad was born in Ballyfarnan in County Roscommon in 1929. His dad was a Garda in the local barracks, so which meant he was sort of on the move a good bit. So basically, I think my dad lived in about four different barracks in Roscommon. By the age of 12, he was always moving. But his favourite place was Terminbarry, which was the last place where he went. He used to love fishing on the Shannon there. So he went to school in Sligo. He got a scholarship to Summerhill College in Sligo. And, you know, that was a big transition from the freedom of childhood. And he writes about that in his book as well, about the experience of being in boarding school, which was kind of, you know, not an altogether positive experience. It was harsh and away from his family and all that. And after boarding school, he moved to Dublin. He took up a job in Dublin Port. He worked in the payroll office for a while, and kind of moved up through the ranks over the years. He became planning officer later on in his career, and married and settled in Dublin. Retired, you know, after 40 years of service or more, 45, I think he was 65 when he retired. He was always writing as he worked, even when he studied in Trinity. And I should have said he went to Trinity at night time when he moved to Dublin first, got his BCom. So that sort of meant he was always had a reverence for education. And so he was writing right through the years. And then when he retired, John, he was able to fully dedicate himself to writing. He'd spend every day writing, and that's when he really sort of lived the life of a writer. But he put in the work over the years. He had many plays on the radio, had published a collection of short stories in the 90s, had articles in the paper. So he worked a lot on his autobiography then when he retired, and had a few more plays in the radio. And the latest collection was this book, Light Reading for Short Journeys, which we just helped him as his children. We helped him get it together last summer. The summer last year, designing the cover. He had very clear ideas for the cover, which is a lovely train going through a landscape and a sunset, and even for the colour of the cover as well, kind of a light pink colour. And he knew what stories he wanted in it, the order of the stories. And so we got the printouts in November and sold a lot of copies around Christmas. Sadly, my dad passed away in March, just gone March 21.
How old was he?
He was 91. He was 3 days short of being 92. So I think I'm going to start saying he was 92, you know, give him his due.
Yeah,
so now we're sort of just concentrating on publicising his book. I think it's what he wanted. He wanted people to read his words. So we're just getting the word out as much as we can about this lovely, lovely book.
A lot of the stories are about his life and we're talking there about he worked down in the harbour office.
Yes.
Down around where the IFSC is now.
Yes. It was an entirely different landscape as to what it is now back in the day. He took a stroll through, there's one of his stories actually is called A Stroll Through the IFSC, and that he talks about what it was like exactly back then in the 1950s when he worked there, in comparison to now. And that I think the Harbour Master is now a pub, and back then it was an office, and there were loads of supply warehouses with various different shipments of goods over to Ireland. So he took care of all that, and he developed, you know, a real way of working. He managed to make it as efficient as possible for himself, you know. There's some funny stories as well in the book about a computer. There was the commander, I think, was his boss, or they called him the commander, and he wanted to bring in a computer to do all the wages. And everyone was a bit nervous because they thought we're going to lose our jobs and be replaced. But luckily, the computer was a piece of junk and ended up paying people far more than they should have got, which worked out well for some people. But
what's the name of that story?
That is called An Early Computer Story. I won't spoil the pleasure of reading it because it's quite funny.
There's some memoirs of Dublin in the 1950s.
Yeah, in the book My Digs Odyssey, which I've just read, it sort of paints a real picture of, you know, people riding around on bikes and less traffic. And if you've seen all those old photos of Dublin in the 50s, very different to the way it is now, and going to dances and everything. But there's other things he writes about. There's going to the cinemas. You know, the way the cinemas were, the cinema was just a huge thing.
And he also wrote radio plays.
Yes, he did. He wrote several radio plays. Five of them are going to be in a collection soon. We're bringing that out. But that was his real passion, I think, writing radio plays, because he had a real eye for dialogue. He'd hear funny dialogues going on all around him, and like the way Maeve Binchy used to write scraps of things down, my dad would just remember them. And he had a real eye for character as well. I think the plays range in tone from there's some very melancholic pieces. The Tattered Coat is about kind of old age, and The Render Unto Caesar, which would have been his more recent play, is about a sum of money which was found in a church, and it's about who's the rightful inheritor of the money and what use it should be put to. And that's the plot, the argument of the whole thing, and everyone thinks is justified in their own. So it's that gives way to a lot of kind of backstabbing and secrets, and all in a small community. He always wrote his stories set in a small community. There's another one called The Last Post, which is like about a guard the barracks in a very remote place in Ireland, and the phone rings every once in a while about something, like a cat getting stuck in a tree or something, or somebody's door won't work, but then something happens one day and it's a bigger deal.
And you're planning to publish the five radio plays in one volume?
Yes.
You staged, was it The Tattered Coat?
No. We staged Under the Plum Tree.
Under the Plum Tree.
Yeah. So the original title of that play was Legal Matters, and it's a one-act play. It was a half an hour long, and that was on RTE Radio. And in that, it's it takes place in a waiting room between a couple, an elderly couple and a younger man, and stories are exchanged about the reasons why they're there. It's a bit of a dark black comedy. So we adapted that for stage in 2005 for the Teachers Club. The Dublin Shakespeare Society acted it very well. And the thing is, with the plays, they're easily adaptable for stage. Even the stories, there's just the dialogue is great, and the plots and the characters. So the Dublin Shakespeare Society are going to read another one of Dad's plays in the autumn. We just thought it might be nice as the nights draw in. It'll probably be on Zoom with the way things are, but there will definitely be a link for that on my dad's website when that happens.
What's the name of your dad's website?
That is www.patrickjpower.com. Yeah.
If I can find any of the audio recordings for the radio plays, I'd be very interested in
featuring
them.
Absolutely. Yeah. We haven't digitized them yet. They're all sort of on CDs and tapes.
Yes.
We do have copies, so that's another thing I'd like to work on to make that accessible to people. Okay. I think with the pandemic, radio plays have kind of come back a little bit, and a lot of acting groups are, you know, engaging with the audio rather than the visual. Is kind of hard to do on Zoom sometimes. So I think
at the Dublin Shakespeare Society, they're skilled readers.
Very skilled. Yeah. Skilled, like the Dublin Shakespeare Society are a group, they've been going for years, and there's a lot of professional and non-professional actors. There's a big mix of actors and a lot of experience and a lot of a huge age range. So I would have, you know, I've acted in some of the plays myself.
Have you?
Yes, not saying anything about how that went, but yeah. I would have no hesitation in recommending them as a group to go and see or listen to.
And the recent book, Light Reading for Short Journeys, it's stories or memoirs of Dublin, yeah. Dublin from the past, about Dublin, yes. such as the whole formation of
Bull
Wall,
Island, yeah.
Bull Wall,
yeah.
And Captain Bligh. Yeah. There's a story there about Captain
Bligh.
Yeah,
there is a story about Captain Bligh and his whole idea about the formation of the South Wall, I think, a simple plan of changing the orientation of it. And that's something that was interesting to me to read about. You know, my dad was very interested in ships and, you know, the sea, working in Dublin Port. You know, he did a lot of good work in Dublin Port, and I think there was one point they were considering moving the port to Dunleary, and my dad did a lot of work on putting forth reasons as why that would not be a good idea, and it didn't happen. So I guess he did have some power in that decision, you know. But yeah, the stories are about his grandfather as well. My grandfather, my dad's father, who was a huge figure in his life, really, and an inspirational figure, and someone he wrote about as well.
Your father, Patrick J. Power, his mother died when he was young.
Yes, his mother, Mary Traynor, was from Monaghan, and she was a nurse. And unfortunately, when he was only four, she got TB. And she passed away, and very soon after, about a year later, not even a year, his little sister Margie, who would only have been two, passed away as well. So Dad was left with his brother Johnny, who was a little bit younger. Dad was four, Johnny was two, and his father. And it really was a huge change for him, because Johnny was sent to live with another relation in Monaghan, because basically my grandfather had to work. He couldn't manage to raise two small children on his own. So the family, my grandmother from Monaghan's family, kicked in and helped, and that we're still in touch with that side of the family. And then about 3 years later, my grandfather remarried Lily, and a whole new family of brothers and sisters was born. So we've a big family, really, on both sides. Mm-hmm. So my dad has kind of roots everywhere in the country, you might say. So there's a lot of stories in the book about my granddad, John, who I met. I was 7 when he died, and his health wasn't the best in those years, but I do remember him as being a very kind of lovely, warm, slightly eccentric figure. And really, you know, we spent summers visiting Sunnyside, which is the house that features a lot in these stories.
Can you talk a little bit more about light reading for short stories? You mentioned that he has advice for would-be writers or
yes.
other writers.
Yes, he does. So based on his experience, John, over the years of writing and, you know, committing to writing every day, like no matter what had happened, Dad would write in the evening. He had a very good routine, which is something I think Stephen King recommends, like write every day. So he said himself he didn't know if any of it was worthwhile, but a lot of it was worthwhile. I think he was being hard on himself, but it's no joke to come home after a day's work and set yourself to writing, especially with a family, you know. So it's we all knew Dad was a writer from an early age in mm-hmm. the house. And
When do you think he started writing initially?
Well, I think he started writing in his mind probably years before he actually... I think with all the places he lived, he was always looking at characters, and, you know, with his father being a guard, the sergeant, there was always different people coming into the barracks, because like back then you lived in the barracks as well. So all those characters were in his mind. I think he first started submitting things to papers when he came to Dublin, but he was writing when he was in school. I think that was when he started reading in a big way as well, and reading was an escape for him. And
this is the boarding school,
yeah, in Summerhill in Sligo. He just sort of read a load of books in Irish. He said he read all the books in the library, a voracious reader really, and that was a sort of source of pleasure for him. And then I think when he came to Dublin, he studied in Trinity, and he took a break. I think he did a BCom and then a DPA, but he took a break in the middle so as he could write a bit, you know, and that's what he did.
Getting back to his other book, he has a book from the 1990s called The End of the Honey Flow.
Yeah, so that's The End of the Honey Flow and Other Stories, and that was a collection he self-published in 1994. and that sold very well. I have to say it was on the bestseller list in Easons at Christmas that year, and he launched the book. You know, sadly my mother passed away around the time that the book was coming out, so it was really bittersweet, the coming of the book. But like now, I suppose he had the book to keep him going at a difficult time, and now we have Dad's book to keep us going in at a difficult time.
And is that 1994 book, The End of the Honey Flow, is that still available?
Yes, it is. We do still have some copies of the book. So that's available on his website, patrickjpower.com, as well as Light Reading for Short Journeys. And I think all the characters in it, it is fiction. Unlike Light Reading for Short Journeys, The End of the Honey Flow, they're fictional stories. They're all very anecdotal about local characters. And I think, you know, it's a book that even a child would enjoy, you know, okay. A reader. And it has been enjoyed by some of my friends' children. They've read the stories to them and they've read them themselves. And like that, you could appreciate it as an adult as well.
And it was popular. It sold well.
Yeah, it sold really well. Yeah. It's a lovely. People are still buying it and have remarked on the flow of the stories and the unity of. My dad loved the idea of the unity of time and place as well. So, yeah.
A lot of the stories are kind of your grandfather. Your grandfather was a Garda who retired early, and bought some land down in County Wexford where he was originally born.
Yes. That's true.
And can you talk about some of the stories that are featured in?
Yeah, I can. So my grandfather, John, was born in Wexford near Duncormac. And he always had this dream about getting back to Wexford. So when he was in his 50s, he decided to take early retirement and go back to Wexford. And with my dad, who was 17 at the time, they cycled around Wexford looking at properties, and they came across this ramshackle house with beautiful land around it. And my dad said he doesn't think that his father even noticed the house, that he was so taken with the land. So that the house was bought, despite a lot of advice to the contrary. And the house was called Sunnyside, and it's in Broadway, which is near Our Lady's Island in the south of Wexford near Rosslare. And that would have been sort of in 1944 that they moved there. So for my granddad, as soon as he moved in, and then he moved his family in, you know, he was able to see his dreams come to fruition. He was the kind of man that my dad would have said that dreams and reality were one. So he had plans to create apple orchards and to sell honey and gooseberry bushes, and he did. But the most strongest thing was the these are all written about in the collection, but one of the stories is called Gooseberry Picking. Mm-hmm. And that's about, you know, every summer we would all go down as a family and we'd have to help my granddad pick gooseberries. And I don't know if you've ever eaten a gooseberry, John. Like, they're not the nicest fruit to eat. And they're hairy and they're spiky. They hurt your hands to pick them. So we all had to do this. And then we'd end up going back to Dublin with bags and bags of gooseberries in the boot, you know. Yeah. And we'd somehow make jam from them. But my dad kind of has fond memories of picking these gooseberries every summer. Because he said they'd have these amazing conversations. They talk about everything from, you know, the price of bread to Hitler's mustache, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a kind of a nostalgic memory as the sun was setting, picking gooseberries. And then there were other things as well about the advent of electricity, and that there was the electricity board wanted to, you know, my grandfather was very suspicious about this, and he thought it would mean the house would be, would go on fire, a thatched house. So he resisted that for a long time, despite the family kind of trying to convince him otherwise. He was quite a character, really. He had a tendency to keep left as well. There's a whole story called Keeping Left about my granddad's tendency to walk on the left or to drive on the left. Or I won't spoil the pleasure by telling you, it's a really funny story. But, you know, there's all that, but there was such a huge amount of love between them, the two of them. And really, I think they were just each other's best friend for a long time. And it was always a sad parting whenever we went to Wexford in the summer and Dad and Grandad would say goodbye to each other. They were always sad to say goodbye. They lived in a thatched house which burnt down though at some point. I think thatched houses were a fire hazard anyway, but I don't think unless they burnt down, they wouldn't have been replaced or rebuilt. So there was a house was rebuilt in 1980, okay, which is the house that's still there today.
And your family still use the house?
Yes, it's still in the family, yeah. It's there's a load of our cousins. We gather every August in the house, and all the, you know, the grandchildren, great-grandchildren have a great time playing in the house, and you know, it's alive and well. I think it's something my granddad would be happy to see, the house in such, you know, being lived in and all that.
So memories of the past in the
of memories of the past, a lot of sort of you know, nice memories, positive memories and funny memories as well, you know, of my granddad. But they did have a very, as I said, they had a closeness. And you know, when my grandmother died, I think my father would have done anything to make him feel better. And apparently on the day in the hearse coming from the funeral, my dad promised his father, my granddad, that he would become a priest. And you know, that he was 4 at the time, so that's a hell of a promise to make at an early age. And then it became, you know, later on, then when, you know, there was sort of, you know, innocent dates with girls and stuff, became apparent that that was not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. He had to disappoint granddad, but he took it on the chin, you know, he mm-hmm. understood. Mm-hmm. And thank God, because I wouldn't be here today if not.
Yeah, you were saying that your father worked really hard on his writing. Every day from Monday to Friday, he would dedicate some portion of the day to sitting down and putting pen to paper.
Yeah, every morning he would write from 10 until 1. And then in the afternoon he liked to go cycling, and he liked to read as well. He liked to work in the garden. He mm. enjoyed the simple things in life. Mm. He had a quite set in his routine. Had dinner at a certain time. Loved potatoes, you mm. know. And then he watched a lot of football as well. He was used to play GAA back in the day. He loved watching football and snooker. So he had his interests, and he did that right up until the age of 89, a couple of years ago, before he died.
Cycling.
Yeah, cycling around Mahini. A lot of people have said, oh, I remember seeing your dad on the bike, or they'd say, saw your dad on the bike today. He cut a familiar figure cycling down to the beach and up around Raheny and cycling to the shops as well. He loved the bike, yeah.
What writers did he admire?
Well, a lot. He mentions that Somerset Maugham was a huge inspiration to him as well. And also Anthony Trollope, because Anthony Trollope was a postal worker mainly, but then would write as well in his spare time, in his free time, had a routine, and I think he used to write 250 words in a quarter of an hour. So that was a big deal. And Guy de Maupassant as well was inspirational in writing the short story. Mm. I think he's been talked about as being one of the perfect short story writers. And Roald Dahl as well was quite, you know, I think Roald Dahl has that broad appeal to children and adults, and even
a good storyteller.
A very good storyteller, yeah. Also John McGahern, because there's certain parallels. I think John McGahern had a rough childhood as well, and was sent to boarding school, didn't love it, and from a kind of a similar area as well,
yeah,
in Ireland.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's some books in the house of some really early collections of John McGahern's, which would have been very cheap, like 10 pence or something back then, you know, the price of books. And yeah, he just admired anyone who had like Guy de Maupassant had a clarity of form and an economy of words, which he loved. And Dad, just even to talk to him, he had a lovely way of telling a story. He was very easy to listen to. He had a kind of a lyrical way of using words as well. And he didn't like a lot of artifice that was found in a lot of writing. He liked stories that just told a story in a beautiful way, but in a way that captured the reader.
Yeah, you were saying that he used to hear a lot of interesting stories when he was growing up in the police barracks.
Yes, he did. Yeah, he would. That was characters as well coming in with various complaints about what was happening and how things were sorted, and you know, this sometimes the smallest of things, or what we would think would be a tiny thing, is huge in someone's life. And you know, Dad captures all that in the stories, I think. And also, like, how a character, that how you have to just heap on the difficulties that you put a character in, you know, in the desert with no water, and maybe no legs, or you
make
know,
him suffer,
make him really suffer, and then you know, go from there. So you elicit the sympathy, get the character on the side of the character.
He also wrote an autobiography.
Yes, he did. That was something he had been working on for years, and that was like a real retirement project. He called it Turn Up the Light, which is a quote from a short story writer, O. Henry, and the full quote is, "Turn up the light, I don't want to go home in the dark," which I think he was referring to life and death in that. That's what my dad, that would have been his idea, that a way, his project of putting his whole life down on paper, his working life, his original, you know, where he was from. And it's really wonderful for us as his family to have that, to have all his words. You know, we know it all so well. We read the stories to him when he was sick. We know it really, really very well at this stage. And I feel very lucky and grateful to have that.
Where could I find that book?
So that book is at the moment available on Amazon. It's available in paper book form, or you can get it on Kindle form on Amazon, and there's a link to that on his website, patrickjparra.com.
The autobiography is called Turn Up the Light.
Turn Up the Light.
Where else, apart from your dad's website, patrickjparra.com, is there any other online website or platform?
Yes, so at the moment, this book, Light Reading for Short Journeys, is the book we're sort of mainly concentrating on at the moment, because it's the most recent book. This is available in various shops in Dublin. At the moment, it's available in some of the Spars in St. Gabriel's and Clontarf. It's available in Verbena in Bayside. It's available in the Bookhaven in Sutton, Adams Pharmacy in Raheny, and Mace in St. Anne's. And because my dad was from the country, we've gone further afield, and it's now available in various shops in Roscommon, Sligo, Mayo, Donegal, Wexford, Waterford, and soon enough Monaghan, hopefully. We're going to get around. We're going to make sure his words reach everyone. We're even thinking of America as well at this stage. But it's just the thing about an author, if you don't continue the work, if an author doesn't get read, or if people don't know about him, he sort of a person dies twice. We don't want that to happen, so that's why the book is also, Light Reading is also available on a website called Buy the Book. So that's BUYTHEBOOK, and this is a marketplace of an online marketplace of self-published authors. There's about 30 authors on the site. All their books are available there. It's also a very good support group for self-published authors, and they've been very supportive to me in promoting Dad's work, giving ideas of where to go with the book, and which is why I've been kind of doing a tour around Ireland and trying to get the book into various places. So it's a very, very supportive community.
So next stop, Monaghan Town?
Next stop, Monaghan Town and Monaghan County. And more in Sligo as well. You know, luckily Dad had roots and in lots of different places in Ireland, so there's lots of connections. Hopefully people will be talking about him in the north, south, east and west of the county before too long.
Don't forget County Cork.
Of course not. Yeah. No, that's Cork and Kerry are huge. Yeah, I'm a bit afraid of them. But I have to, I want to get the link. And
What about Limerick? Did you mention Limerick?
No, haven't been to Limerick yet.
So they're the three big frontiers.
Yeah, they are, yeah.
So the book is called Light Reading for Short Journeys, and it came out November 2020, and I've been talking to Nessa Power, Patrick J. Power's daughter. We'll finish off with another story, and it's called Memories of the Shannon.
Yes, Memories of the Shannon by Patrick J. Power, in light reading for short journeys. In 30 years as a Garda sergeant, my father's career spanned 5 counties and 9 stations. For his family, that meant we were constantly on the move without putting down roots in any one place. As the eldest, I had lived in 4 County Roscommon villages by the time I was 7. Ballyfarnan, where I was born, Keju, then Tulsk, where my mother died, and finally Terminbarry, a small village on the River Shannon. Ballyfarnan and Keju I don't remember, and of Tulsk I have only scattered recollections. If I have any childhood roots at all, they are in Terminbarry. A small rural community, life in Terminbarry was calm and unhurried. There were 5 shops, but, unusual for an Irish village, no school or church. The Dublin Ballina bus passed through twice a day, once in each direction, stopping only to pick up or set down passengers. Traffic on the river comprised almost exclusively freight barges carrying flour, cement, and other bulk cargo upriver from Limerick and Athlone. My first glimpse of the Shannon was on a midwinter morning with frost on the fields. I could scarcely believe my eyes, this huge river on my doorstep, a vast playground promising adventure and excitement. I raced down the towpath to the lock gates, inspected nearby the large red and white boathouse built on stilts, clambered onto the weir, and from the catwalk watched the water tumble through the sluices onto the stones below. My heart filled with wonder. All this was mine. Fishing became my passion. Home from school in Whitehall, a mile away, I gulped down my dinner, grabbed my fishing rod and a jar of worms, and hurried to the bridge. There I remained until I was called home, some hours later, hanging over the parapet, waiting for the cork to bob as another perch was hooked. I got to know the weather that was good for fishing, and that which was not. Fish, like humans, disliked rainy conditions with dark overcast skies, and preferred sun on the water. As I got older, I explored other areas of the river. I discovered small trout could be caught under stones in the shallow water at the bottom of the weir. 2 or 3 made a tasty dinner. Sometimes I accompanied my father fly fishing, but I never took to it. Bites were sporadic, and I missed the excitement of waiting for the cork to bob and weave. Occasionally, we took a boat out and went trawling for pike, pulling a spoon bait behind us. One evening we caught a 16-pounder and got our picture in the local paper. Pat Kerrigan, the local blacksmith, taught me how to catch bream. Each day for a week, before he started fishing, he fed a particular part of the river that he called a bream hole, with a mixture of bread, pollard and potato skins. Bream fed on the bottom of the river, he told me, and the best time to catch them was in late evening as darkness fell. They had soft mouths and had to be reeled in gently. They were known to be nice fish to eat, but I never liked them, and any I caught, I gave away. In summer, English anglers came, and my knowledge of the river proved profitable. I showed them where to fish and what bait to use. For some reason, many of them liked fishing for roach. The best place to catch roach was a sheltered spot called the Jetty, where the Royal Canal joins the Shannon downriver from the lock gates. Bait was bread moistened and rolled into a small ball fixed to the top of the hook. When the visitors departed, they often left me a treasure trove of equipment: line, hooks, spinners, and fancy floats. One young man who came 2 years on his own sent me a postcard showing where he worked in London. In the early days of World War II, word came through that he had become a pilot in the Fleet Air Arm and had lost his life over the English Channel. Although I fished many parts of the river, my favourite place remained the bridge. Not a day passed that I didn't spend some time there. Then the future encroached on my life. My father arranged for me to get extra tuition to enable me to sit for a county council scholarship. I found a way of getting out unseen through the back of the barracks by lowering myself from an upstairs window onto a galvanised roof and then jumping to the ground. I fished under the bridge where I couldn't be seen. But the subterfuge didn't last long. The teacher complained to my father that I was wasting his time and my fishing days were numbered. One Sunday afternoon in July, when I was 13, the annual regatta in Tarmanbury was taking place. I was sitting on steps leading up to the lock gates, watching the greasy pole competition, when I saw my father walking down the towpath, his thumbs hooked into his top tunic pockets and the sun glinting off the chevrons on his sleeve. He strode over to me with a big smile on his face. He had got a phone call to say I had won a scholarship. There, you could say, my childhood ended. A month or so later, I went to Summerhill College, Sligo. Within a year, my father transferred to Clonasslee in Laois, and then on to Villierstown in Waterford, his last station before retiring to his native Wexford. And with a heavy heart, I bade goodbye to Tarmanbury and my beloved Shannon. In appearance, Tarmanbury has changed over the years. There is a new bridge, the boathouse has been demolished, and the older houses with patched and galvanised roofs have been replaced by modern bungalows. The shop fronts have been modernised and a small hotel has been built. Tourist cruisers stop there now and the freight traffic is no more. One can hear voices from many countries, German, French, Dutch, and from further afield. But much has remained the same. The lock gates and the towpath are still there, and the Shannon flows serenely by as it always did. If you grow up beside a river, it stays with you all your life. Whenever I return to Tarmanbury, cross the humpback bridge in Clondra, drive the hill past what used to be Klein's Waterfall, hit the rising ground again and see the Shannon below me, the old days come flooding back. I hear the roar of the water as it tumbles over the weir, and I smell again the wild scent of spray in the air. I stop outside the barracks, now unoccupied, but once home to me and my family. The years roll away, and a small boy in a jumper and short pants carrying a fishing rod and a jar of worms emerges and hurries up to the bridge. I follow him in my mind's eye and see the other landmarks of my childhood. The hawthorn bush hanging over the water, near where my father and I caught the big pike, and down from it the bream hole where I sat with Pat Kerrigan into the small hours. In the distance I see the jetty where I helped the English visitors catch roach, and up from it the shallower water where my father cast for trout. The strange thing is, after I left Tarmanbury, I never fished again.
That was Memories of the Shannon, a short memoir from collection of short stories called Life Reading for Short Journeys by Patrick J. Power. The reading was read by Patrick J. Power's daughter, Nessa Power. Any last words?
Well, John, I just want to say thanks for the interview and for giving me the opportunity to talk about my dad and to talk about his book. It's very special to have really this to talk about and to, you know, keep him alive in lots of people's memories, and so thank you for your time and for allowing me to bring my dad to life for your listeners.
Nessa Power, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
So two stories from Light Reading for Short Journeys. Nessa Power read My Digs Odyssey, and to finish off, Memories of the Shannon from Patrick J. Power's short story collection, and Memoirs from Patrick J. Power's Life. Many of the stories were first published in various periodicals, including The Evening Press, The Irish Press, The Irish Times, Ireland's own Aer Lingus Flight Magazine, Ireland of the Welcomes, Farmer's Journal, Sacred Heart Messenger, Roscommon Yearbook, Garda News, Wexford Yearbook, Writers News, Writing Magazine, and Sutton Park School Annual. For further information, if you want to take a look at www.patrickjpower.com. And the other good site is buythebook.com. That's BUYTHEBOOK. And they also have a Facebook page, Buy the Book. Scroll down there and you'll see a mention of the new book published 2020, Light Reading for Short Journeys by Patrick J. Power. That's it for the programme. You're listening to the Arts Programme, or the Art Show, here on Near FM 90.3. I hope you keep well and enjoy the week. We'll bring another show to you in a fortnight's time. Slán agus bannacht.